Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right, thanks for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. You are listening to a special studio session, and we are coming to you live from the back of Roberta's Pizza in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and today we're taking a little trip to Paradise Lot. We're on the line with Eric Tonesmeyer, author of Paradise Lot, Two Plant Geeks and One-Tenth of an Acre. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
It's great to have you on. So I'm excited to tuck right in. Why don't you give us a little setup? What is Paradise Lot?
Well, it's the story of our own home garden here. My friend and I had lived in the country and gardened back there, but we really felt like we wanted to move to the city to show what can be done with edible landscaping on a small lot with terrible soil. And we also hope by moving to the city, we might have better luck finding sweethearts, which it turns out that we did.
Now, sweethearts, you're not talking about that tangy sweet candy, are you?
No. Looking for sweeties to spend our lives with.
So the focus of the type of growing you guys do on the lot is permaculture. And I thought we would start the show by talking about what permaculture is and what it isn't.
Sure. Well, my definition of permaculture, to me, what's unique about permaculture, and it can be kind of defined so broadly that it encompasses all of sustainability, which I don't find terribly helpful personally. What's unique about it is it's looking at how to plug pieces together to create something that's more than the sum of its parts. So how that would apply to the garden is, let's say we have vegetable beds here, and we pull the weeds from those and feed them to our chickens. And the chickens eat them and use them to help create eggs and lots of manure. And they scratch up whatever greens they don't eat or whatever weeds they don't eat and poop on all of it. And it mixes with their bedding really nicely. And we end up getting compost that can go back on the vegetable beds. So we're trying to create these closed loops and these functional interconnections between the pieces to create a garden that comes alive as an ecosystem. And that's a very short definition of permaculture.
Something about permaculture, I mean, I guess it makes me think permanent, but that's not the point, right?
Well, it's a contraction of permanent agriculture, and we do strongly emphasize in permaculture the perennial plants, which will live for years and years and keep coming back and making food. In our garden in particular, we emphasize perennial fruits and perennial vegetables. We have some broccolis, for example, that are now 12 years old, and they keep coming back strongly from their mature root systems every year and making those spring broccolis for us, like in April and early May, when annual broccolis are still just 1 inch tall.
So I have a question. You know, I guess because they're kind of already part of the working ecosystem from year to year, they're going to have a head start, or they're going to be maybe more in tune with the weather or with the kind of fluctuations in the soil from year to year. But what happens when you like no longer want that plant or that variety growing in that space? Or what, let's say you change your mind and you want your broccoli kind of in a different spot. What do you do?
That's a great question. Sometimes they're easy to dig up and move somewhere else. Typically, they're easy to dig up and move. Sometimes, however, they leave pieces of themselves behind that continue to grow. And a few of the species we grow have been kind of problematic for us to get rid of. So then we use a technique called sheet mulching or lasagna gardening, where we lay big pieces of cardboard down on top and then put compost and then wood chips on top of that. And that tends to smother them out pretty well over the course of a year.
Oh, wow. That's it's like...
And it's an inexpensive technique. Cardboard,
yeah,
and wood chips are easy to come by.
Well, and I've also heard that people say permaculture is good if you're like kind of a lazy gardener and you're not really into, weeding. But I mean, is that true, or is that kind of something they tell me because I want to get into gardening, but I don't want to do a lot of work?
Well, that's what we say a lot in permaculture, is it's about being lazy. My experience is that there are pieces of our garden that are very low maintenance that we've been able to set on automatic pilot, and they come back every year. However, Jonathan and I end up redoing some pieces of the garden every year because we want to try something new. And the establishment phase is not low maintenance. The establishment phase is high maintenance. So you have to design it. You have to put it in place. And then if you did it right, then it's easy after that. So I think then that's when they say the designer becomes the recliner. Well, for us, that's never fully happened because we always are wanting to try something new somewhere here.
And I guess
but it's less work. It's less work
at
than
some
annual
point.
Gardening.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes. But not zero.
Well, you know, I think anything that you would do that would require no work, I think you could probably have pretty low expectations for those outcomes. But I suppose we should be clear with folks that you are not talking about some, you know, farming system that you're building out in some kind of bucolic countryside. You guys set up shop right in the middle of Holyoke, like right in the middle of the Massachusetts Rust Belt. So give us a sense of the size of your space and, you know, why it was, you know, that you located there in particular. It seems like a challenging and unconventional spot to lay down and try and farm.
Sure. Well, one reason to move here is that it's affordable, and we like affordability. But really, I've been working here in urban agriculture in Holyoke since 1994 with a group called Nuestras Raices that does community gardens and has an urban farm and does a bunch of really cool stuff here in the city. So I fell in love with Holyoke doing that, and I wanted to be here partly because I felt like what we were doing would be more relevant than being out in the country somewhere. More people have a little plot. So the house is it's a duplex. So the idea was we would eventually meet our sweethearts and each get our own side of the house, but be able to continue to share the garden together, like a little tiny eco village or something, if you will, I guess. Or a condo with really good shared edible backyard or something. And so it's a tenth of an acre, which the backyard, which is the main area where we can grow things, is 90 by 45, which is not, wouldn't be out of place in Brooklyn or a lot of, it's not downtown Manhattan or L.A., but a lot of folks have a 90 by 45 piece of land to work with.
And do you feel like you guys, like the outcome has been what you expected with regards to being able to engage with more people and engage in the neighborhood and kind of do some cross-pollination around the ideas of food production?
You know, I think we've made less difference than we thought right here in the neighborhood, although certainly lots of people have come on, lots of our neighbors like to come and, you know, visit us and eat our fruit, and we planted a hedge in the front yard just for the local kids to come eat fruit from, and some people have planted raspberries and strawberries and pears and stuff around us. The bigger difference has more been, I think, with folks from outside who've come in, and we must have done almost 3,000 people coming on tours at this point over the last 10 years, which is quite a lot. So we've been able to have a bigger impact outside of the neighborhood than in the neighborhood, which is sort of the opposite of what we had planned for.
Yeah, so let's talk about that kind of shifts in the world of urban agriculture. I mean, community gardening has a long history, I know, here in New York City, but across the country as a space for people to produce food, but also to engage in, you know, neighborly activities. And I wonder, because you guys have been, you know, sitting at this kind of unique purview, what your thoughts are on the movement. I mean, has it been grown in the way that you would expect it to? Do you find that you have more allies in different cities and there's like a growing collection of knowledge? Or are you feeling optimistic about urban gardening or pessimistic?
I feel very optimistic in that the practices are really pretty much proven at this point. The how-to is totally mastered, and that would be not just the gardening part, but the community organizing part. There's just so much good knowledge about that now, and there's so many people doing good work connecting cities to farms and all that. I mean, New York is really, you guys have Just Food and all these really cool places really making that happen. There's actual urban farms making money, selling stuff, which I think is very exciting. I think that the challenge in the urban ag movement right now is that a lot of the drivers are nonprofits, a lot of the organizations like Growing Power and Added Value and so on around the country are nonprofits. And there's just not enough funding to fund an organization like that in every city. But we need an organization like that in every city in the country.
And what do you see as like the primary benefits of those organizations for the community members that they serve?
Well, I mean, certainly nutrition is one, and I think getting people outside and doing some exercise is good. But what really it seems like is that food is a great issue to organize a community around in general. So with Nuestros Raices here in Holyoke, our community gardens, we have 10 of them around the city, and each one elects two coordinators every year. And that sort of grassroots democracy at the kind of block-by-block level. And out of that group have emerged a bunch of leaders who maybe never would have thought of themselves taking responsibility for anything in their community before. So a lot of them have gone on to join the board of directors there or have gone on to become staff or do other things around the city. So I feel like one of the real biggest impacts of urban agriculture is actually just the community building and leadership development component. Certainly nutrition is great and jobs are great and all those things are excellent, but the social issues are typically much more challenging than the agricultural ones has been my experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, too, of where you guys are located. I know Holyoke is one of the poorer cities in the country and has kind of typical inner city problems, high rates of unemployment, drug gang activity. Has that impacted your farm at all? I mean, do you come into contact with that environment? And what's the response to plant nerds basically sitting down in their midst to grow a funky garden?
Well, you know, here at the house, the one challenge, I've contacted more when I ran the farm down the road. Here at the house, the only real challenge is that our next-door neighbor was being busted for selling coke, and while the cops were there raiding them with their guns drawn and everything, they saw that we had chickens, which are illegal in our city, and busted us for having chickens. Because those two crimes are sort of on a roughly equal, level there, I figure, right? Then when I worked at the farm, when I ran the farm down the road, we worked with immigrant and refugee farmers to help them start their own farm operation, and we had a lot of livestock stealing there. People would come in and take six full-grown pigs the night before they were going to be sold, and people would steal goats and things like that. So those were definite challenges for us there. When you're a very limited resource farmer and you only have six pigs and someone comes and steals them right before you were going to sell them, that's a major discouraging setback. So,
and what do you think? I mean, do you think that they're taking those pigs to another slaughter facility, or are they just kind of, I mean, what do you think is happening with the stolen pigs? Is it someone who needs them for food, do you think, or is it
people
someone
just... People are eating them, yeah. People are absolutely eating them. The good and bad of being in Holyoke is there's a lot of folks who grew up in the mountains of Puerto Rico, and they have rural skills, and they know how to kill pigs. They came in, they killed the pigs right in the pen and dragged them out dead, because you could never drag a 150-pound pig out without making so much noise.
Yeah.
And I think somebody had a really big party and ate a lot of pork is probably what happened, which you can't begrudge somebody that much. You know, people are hungry. They need food. We get that. But also, it's kind of the wrong person to steal it from or something as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we need to take a short break. But when we get back, I want to talk a little bit more about your chicken bust and some other facts about the farm. So hang tight. We'll be right back.
Life is what they say. Sun erases again. Everything I'm hoping for, but I don't need you.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. For more information, visit cane5.com.
All right, we are back. You're tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. We are on the line with Eric Tonesmeyer, author of Paradise Law, and we're talking about some radical urban gardening, urban farming. So before the break, you were talking a little bit about one of the unexpected consequences of your neighbors getting busted for coke distribution was you guys getting in trouble for raising chickens in your backyard. I know here in New York State in the city, there was a lot of efforts put in the recent years to make it legal to raise chickens here. And in your book, you write that poultry seems like a racially charged issue. And I'm curious, you know, what you meant by that and if anything has changed since you guys got busted.
Sure. Well, Holyoke is a very kind of unique demographic in that while it's a city that has seen waves of immigrants come through, they were all European immigrants up until the wave of folks came from Puerto Rico, let's say 30, 40 years ago. So we have a city that's just about half white and half Hispanic, almost all from Puerto Rico. And at this point, actually, a city where half the population is 25 years old or younger. So it's a very interesting city where things are changing in the public schools. 90% are from, are from Puerto Rico, our Puerto Rican heritage. So we've got a very interesting city, and yet, you know, who runs the city, who dominates the city council and so on is the white folks. So to speak very broadly and generalize wildly, I would say that there's a strong conservative voice in the white community here that wants the city to go back to being an industrial giant, which may or may not be feasible. You know, manufacturing is not really rocking in the United States right now. And to them, it's mostly the Puerto Rican folks who want to have chickens, because where they grew up, everybody had chickens as pets. People had chickens in the city, and they want to do that here. It's partly an expression of their culture, and it's partly a sensibility about food security. And so a lot of the issue in Holyoke is really a sort of a somewhat cloaked way to try and keep Puerto Rican folks from being able to do and be who they are. And a lot of that came out in the conversations when we did try to pass a chicken legislation here, which was pretty harshly shot down in city council. It definitely failed miserably in the city council.
And when was that?
That was like 3 or 4 years ago. We do have a new mayor who's very progressive, Alex Morse, and I'm a fan of his. But the city council has still got a lot of the same folks on it, and I think for the time being we're not going to see a chicken law pass in Holyoke. So we still have them, and we feel like basically what they told us when they came before is here's a $0 fine. If we have to come back, it's a $25 fine, and we'll come back if there's a complaint from a neighbor. So we keep them well-fed and smelling nice and healthy, so they don't bother our neighbors, and we haven't had any complaints. And our neighbors grew up in Brazil and the former Soviet Union and Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic, and they're all used to chickens in the backyard, and it doesn't bother. We don't have a rooster, so that doesn't seem to bother anybody. So far, so good.
Good, good. Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed for you. And if you have to face that $25 fine, give us a call. We'll do an on-air pledge raise to draw some attention to that.
That's right.
To that issue. Well, and you know, hopefully, given some of the progress we've made down here in the city, there's, you know, emerging models for tackling issues like that and bringing a more diverse group of voices to the table. So it's not, you know, strictly, you know, one side versus the other, that there's a broader kind of spectrum to look to for examples and leadership in those types of policy issues.
Absolutely. And we've been part of there's a food policy council in Holyoke that I was part of for many years, and we came up with a whole platform of policy recommendations, chickens being just one very much on the bottom of the list. So we're still hoping that those policies get passed through, and really chickens aren't the number one priority in terms of food security and nutrition in the city anyway. You know, getting good, healthy stuff in the schools has got to be number one, and that's frankly more important than backyard chickens, I think.
So I'm curious, what prompted you to write the book? When did you decide you were going to sit down and kind of put all these great stories together in a package for readers like myself?
Well, you know, I've written how-to gardening books before, and somebody suggested to me that I should think about trying to tell it in a different voice, to pass the same information on in a different mode, and that people often would rather hear a story than read a how-to book. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, it seems like a very arrogant thing to do, to write the story of your garden as though someone else has something to learn from it. But I thought about the tours we've done and the impact that's had on people, and when I go around and do classes, what it's like for people when they see the transformation from this barren lot to this really very lovely, productive, food-producing ecosystem. And I realized there really is something in the power of that story. That's what made me decide to write it.
And how did you find the writing process? I mean, given that you were approaching it in this from a new purview, essentially, you know, less of a kind of straight didactic how-to, but sharing some of the personal stories. Did it bring up any kind of memories or spur conversations about things you'd maybe forgotten about that you would want to share with us?
Sure. Well, the first thing I had to do was reconstruct the timeline of what happened when. That was kind of a slow process. When did we do that, and when did this happen? And partly that was using photographs and looking at the dates on the photos and trying to figure out when these different pieces happened. And so that was very interesting to figure out when all these things actually went down. And then it made me sort of step back and analyze objectively, well, what were our goals when we set out? And how have we done at accomplishing them? What would a sort of objective evaluation of this be? And I sort of had to look at the fact that while lots of individual things didn't work, overall it's really been a success. And that was kind of cool to really think about. Because when I go out there, all I think about is, oh, I forgot to prune this and I need to deal with that. But to really look at the whole thing, it required me to have a more accurate perspective about success.
Yeah, getting a chance to step back, and you know, sometimes it's nice to recognize in one big chunk the work that you've done and get to see the progress on paper. I mean, I think it's one of the things I find so cool about so many of the authors that work with Chelsea Green is just these really unconventional stories of success and things I think we as a culture need to do a better job celebrating. We're just about out of time, but I thought maybe we'd wrap up if you could maybe give us a little bit of an explanation on kind of one of the more common permaculture traditions that often come across my desk, the tradition of the three sisters. I know you guys do kind of a riff on that, and maybe you could just share with our listeners kind of, you know, what that tradition is and how you guys work with it at the farm.
Sure. Well, corn and beans and squash were domesticated in Mexico, let's say 9,000-10,000 years ago, and slowly that suite of crops made its way north, arriving in the Northeast, let's say around 1,000 years ago, and actually displacing a whole suite of native crops that had been domesticated here already but weren't quite ready for prime time in the same way. And the way people traditionally grow them is the corn is, you know, very tall and straight, and people will plant the beans to climb, climbing beans, pole beans, that will climb on the corn as their trellis. And then underneath they'll grow squashes, which spread out on the ground and help to suppress weeds and serve as sort of a ground cover. We call that a polyculture with these three species growing together. And the traditional indigenous phrase is the three sisters, these three plants that get along well together and grow together. And Jonathan and I love that, and we've grown the true three sisters, and we also decided to try an adaptation of that using perennial species. Instead of corn, we grow Jerusalem artichoke, which is a native tuber crop, and instead of the beans, we grow another nitrogen-fixing climber called groundnut, which is another native one with edible tubers, and then we've tried a mint with edible tubers called Chinese artichoke as the squash analog, as it were. And we had a lot of fun with that. And eventually we've now refined it to the point where we learned that while the Jerusalem artichokes were really happy, the other two were not at their best. And really when you're doing permaculture design, you want every component to be absolutely happy with the conditions you're providing for it. So now we've swapped out. We now have the two brothers, we call them, which is the Jerusalem artichoke, nice and tall, and then hog peanuts, which are a native bean that serves both as a ground cover and a nitrogen fixer and climbs like the regular beans. And they're easy to dig up. When you dig up the Jerusalem artichokes, their beans are underground like a peanut. And it's been really fun to try to look both at nature and horticulture for inspiration in trying to design these low-maintenance systems. And that's one that really seems to work. The sunchoke with hog peanut is a beautiful, simple, easy-to-replicate system with all native plants that make very nice food. So we're pretty happy about that.
Awesome. Well, Eric, thank you so much for taking some time out to share some of your experiences and tell us a little bit more about the book.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And I continue to look forward every time I go down to New York. I love visiting all the urban farms and gardens down there. You guys are really leading the pack, and we all appreciate that.
Awesome. You'll have to come to the studio. We've got a greenhouse on our roof and a garden in our backyard. So
that is awesome. I would love that.
Well, we've just been listening to a little bit of chat with Paradise Lot author Eric Tonesmeyer. You can pick up his book wherever great publications are sold. Thank you so much for tuning in. This, like all 30 of our live weekly shows, is available as a free podcast through iTunes. You can find us on Stitcher Smart Radio or check out all of our program by visiting www.heritageradionetwork.org. Please think about clicking that donate tab. Becoming a member today, we could definitely use your support. And stay tuned in. Always got more stuff coming at you from the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.